Session number 27464, Martin Lamb, part 2.
Can you describe the B-set?
Well, the B-set was in a... It was in the suitcase, and I think the suitcase could look like an ordinary medium size. You've got one here, haven't you, the B-sets? And I can't remember now. There were sockets in which you plugged the... hopefully the right crystal of the right frequency, and then of course you had your skids, and you had a good watches, scheduled watches, which were supposed to record, which was supposed to be a record of how much, how slow or fast they were. Otherwise I can't remember now I can't remember much about the B-set. I don't remember much about the batteries either, although the batteries, of course, were always a preoccupation, because it was a great embarrassment to run out of power. And I think we had pedal machines to charge the batteries with. It was something I've been doing all my life, actually. I've always been a charger of batteries. I still do it. No, it was very important, because I remember one of Bentley's messages, it ran out, the batteries ran out in the middle of a message, which you don't want that to happen. However, the mission was set up, and in due course we were summoned to the airport at, I think, Bari, and we got on this plane with a Polish crew. And we were all very much, we had a lot of clothes on, and we settled down on the plane, which had a large hole through which you would jump out. The training was done through jumping out through the door of the plane, but for these operational planes, so that they could unload canisters and the rest of it, they had a large hole which was covered up, and you couldn't help looking at it during the flight wondering what it had in store for you. Anyway, we went out over the Apennines, and the plane droned on and on, and eventually we got to the dropping point. I'm afraid, in answer to your earlier question, I can't remember where it was. Perhaps we weren't told. And it wasn't obviously in the higher Alps, but it was a dropping point, and the crew saw the flares which the partisans had lit. We then got ready to jump, but the aircraft, having circled round a few times, the crew came out and said sorry, they'd lost the lights and they couldn't drop us. And we went all the way back again. Another droning flight, we all fell asleep. What I'm trying to remember is, perhaps it's not much interest, what the aircraft was. I can't remember at the moment, it may come back to me. Anyhow, we went back, and we landed again, went back to bed in the middle of the night or in the early morning, and we waited for the flight to be rescheduled. But the weather was bad at various times, and we were sent off, as I mentioned to you, several times on a few days' leave, in the course of which I went to Lecce, as I said, with Leonard Petruello. I'm trying to remember whether I also went to Rome at one point on this... A bit of personal anecdotary, which is perhaps unnecessary. I did, in fact, have an old friend from home who was a bomb disposer, and he'd been on a course, and he was in Rome, and I arranged, I can't remember how, to meet him. And when I got there and phoned his unit, they said he'd gone on a course somewhere else, and I gave it up and got myself a ticket for the opera to see, Forza del Destino, Verdi opera, and I think Gigli were singing, or if that's impossible, it means that my memory is at fault. Can't recall now. Anyway, I went to the opera, and I met my friend. So that's a personal and an anecdote which can be... and we then talked all night. We went back to his lodgings. He was in, I mean, he was obviously a soldier too. And we went back and talked all night.
School?
We were at school together for a while, but we lived in the same suburb. He died recently. So that was that. So coming back to the the Italian, the serious Italian business, we never went out again, because by that time it obviously became apparent that the Gustav line, I think it was holding, and the Germans were not retreating in a hurry, and the mission was, I think, cancelled in that form. I think Colonel Stevens went in somewhere else, he parachuted in somewhere else. Cuneo? Anyway, he did. And I was sent to Nice, where, as intelligence officer, as they called it, and our job was to help the partisans both by sea and over the Alps. And our headquarters were in the Villa Monique, and the chap in charge was a man called Betz, squadron leader Betz, whose real name, as I found out only after all, was Buki. He'd been in the hotel trade, and he spoke absolutely marvelous Italian and good, very good French. And he ran the place, the Villa Monique, as if it was a hotel. And we had French servants, and he would, you know, give orders for the meals and so on. But he was a serious man, and he's the one who has put his initials on the diary, which I gave you, yes. The diary of events, because he saw it every now and again. And other people there were Arthur Radley, whom you knew of, a man called Alan MacDonald, whom I've never picked up again. He was a good pianist, but he wasn't the MacDonald who appears in the SOE, Special Force books. Alistair MacDonald, I think, was the other one, and I've never met him again. There was an Olaf Brann, a man of Norwegian, obviously, ancestry, Brann. He had a very bad motor accident. And I remember going to see him
in
Marseille. Yeah. Well, I don't remember where he had the accident.
But while you were in France.
Yes, that's right. And I drove to Marseille to see him in hospital. And on the way, I picked up a very bulky lady who was hitchhiking, who turned out to be a Russian. She was a Russian. And she was... It was the tip of my tongue a moment ago. She was a kind of... second-class doctor, sorry, the name will come to you. Do you mind stopping a moment? Anyway, she was one of these second-class doctors, and was quite good to talk to. And who else was there? A man called Darifa, Guy Darifa, who was a bilingual man from Mauritius. And he was in a Scots regiment and wore a kilt quite often. And... He was in charge, I think, of the administration. We had a number of cars because we needed those operationally, and they kept going wrong, and we had a French mechanic whose you'll stop me if this is irrelevant, whose stock in trade was to take things out if they didn't function. On va débrancher ça, he would say, we'll take it out of circuit, you see, and he was forever doing this, but the cars went on working, luckily, and because of his efforts. But Darifa was quite a funny man. People would say, where's Mauritius? And he'd say, well, Africa is quite near to Mauritius. See? Other people, well, then there was Buffa, whom I will tell, so I, an Italian called Paolo Buffa, a doctor, a medical doctor, who was known to us as Paul Barton before the great detective had been invented. I mean, this is pure coincidence. And he was a fine fellow. He and his family, his fiancée and either his cousin or her cousin, I forget which, had been arrested in Rome by the Germans or by the Italians for distributing anti-Mussolini leaflets. I don't remember quite when. They were brought to court, and the girls, they were all convicted, and the two girls were sent to prison together, and he was condemned to death. But he told me, when they found he was a doctor, they decided not to kill him, and he was let free. But he made his way through the lines to the Allies, and he joined us, he joined Special Force, and he was going to go in either with Radley, no, he was going to go in separately, and did. He was parachuted into the Alpine valleys later in the, as the peace got nearer, before the armistice, to make sure that the Germans or the Italian fascists didn't sabotage the hydroelectric stations in the Alps, which were extremely valuable for North Italy. And he was an excellent man. I thought, I told you, I'll tell you more about him if you like. I'll tell you more about the ladies. Perhaps just one quick word. This is unusual. He came back after he had done his job, making sure that the hydroelectric stations were not damaged. He came back to Nice, and by that time there'd been the armistice, and he said he would like to have a jeep and go to a place called Eichach in Austria, where his fiancée and the cousin were in prison. And I said, well, you'll never find them. But, you know, Europe's full of people. Europe's full of people milling around. And he said, I will find them. When people say there's a British officer in a jeep going round the camp, they'll find me. And he did it, and he brought them back. And I met them later on. They'd been in prison together, and they had learnt songs in their cell, some of which they sang some of them to me. And when I went with my wife on holiday to Italy, perhaps 10 years ago now, nearly 10 years ago, I went to Modena. He taught. After the war, he went back to the university and taught in the medical faculty of the University of Modena. And I went there to see him, but he was already suffering from Parkinson's disease, and I couldn't really get through to him much. But I did speak for a long time, during that day, both to his wife Enrica, with whom I still exchange Christmas cards and telephone calls, and the cousin Vera, who was still living there. And I took the opportunity of asking her particularly, whether he'd been a member of the Communist Party, because I didn't know. He was always very much on the left. And they said he hadn't. And there were such people, as I think I said earlier, who just intuitively knew that Mussolini was a bastard, and who joined the resistance, not because they were communists, but because they knew that he had to be got rid of. And Paolo Buffa was such a person. Well, I'll stop there about him, just to say what I have got is a little book that his wife wrote, that Enrica Buffa wrote when she was in prison, about her experiences there, the letters home and so on, in Italian, and a limited edition. But if it's of interest, you can have it. That was an extraordinary family.
Was he much older than the rest of you? He must have been somewhat older.
Not much, just a few years. I mean, he would have been, I suppose, perhaps 25 or something of that sort. And he wasn't, of course, an Italian, although he was dressed as a British officer. Whether he was gazetted, I don't know. So Now, who else was there? So he was the most, for me, the most striking person whom I met in the Nice operation. There was a Captain Jones, who was an American, who was in charge of the OSS, do I mean?
Yes.
And with whom I had quite a few dealings, because when people arrived, either by sea or over the mountains, somebody had to look after them. And I suppose for financial reasons, he got me to agree that the people we took over, we would pay for. And I'm not sure that was a good deal, because in the end, it turned out that we were paying hotel bills for quite a few people, perhaps some of them of doubtful, you know, utility to the war effort. But they don't. I can't nail anyone as being in that description. Who else in Nice? Oh yes, there were. We had quite close dealings with the French authorities and the police in particular, because they were watching us. I think the French had their own agenda for the border area, Bordighera and all that. And at the end of the war, the French didn't behave very well. You remember, they tried to take over the border area, and there was at one point they may even have had, you know, wanting to have border adjustments. But oh yes, there was a man, I think he was Dumidov. Dumidov was a Frenchman, a Russian. There were a lot of Russians, and one of the Russians was, whom I got to know slightly because he lived near the Villa Monique, was a man who'd been quite a prominent politician. He'd been a prince in Tsarist Russia, and he'd been quite a prominent politician in the government which was set up. Oh, God, the name. Sorry, it'll come back to me. Well, perhaps, would you mind switching off? Yes. I've forgotten the name of this prince, but he had been, I think, in the Kerensky government before, obviously, it was overthrown. And he had a very good-looking daughter who, I think, became engaged to, and I think married, an RAF officer who was also working in those vicinities. Those were among the perils of...
So these were all Russian emigres?
Yes, there were quite a few. I think it must have been after the armistice, I hope, took a course, a Russian course, in the University of the Mediterranean, which was had a branch there. That was funny. All old Russians. I won't bore you with details. I still remember some of the texts that we did. So what more can I tell you about Nice? You've already... Yes.
So you were... Bob Bentley, his mission, of course.
Yes. Bob Bentley went in, and, well, I can't really tell you any more, really, than is in the account. You have his account, haven't you?
So in Nice, your awareness, perhaps, of what Bentley was up to, how aware were you?
Well, I think he was probably the biggest thing we were really running. Perhaps, I think he was the only mission, and a lot of... I remember one particular episode, which is quite important. He sent us a message saying that the partisans intended to attack an Italian barracks, and would we arrange for it to be bombed at this time? And I think it's in the wireless traffic. And I went to see the Americans and arranged this. They said they would do it, and when the day for the attack had passed, the message came back from Bentley saying, everything fine, planes came and we attacked, and the planes came and machine-gunned the barracks, but no bombs. And when I went back to the Americans, they said, oh yes, I'm very sorry, we couldn't spare any bombs on that day. They hadn't told us. But I don't wish to criticize them for this. I mean, I don't know what the other targets were. But that was one thing that could have, you know, been quite spectacular, but it wasn't. Not for Bentley, of course. The partisans were pretty disappointed that they got the planes but not the bombs. I also remember that several occasions boats Robin Richards was in charge of the arrangements for landing supplies and arms to the partisans on the Italian shore. And they went out several times. I remember the expeditions down to the beach. I asked whether I could go on one of them, but the Squadron Leader Betts, I think, rightly said that it would be wasteful. I mean, I couldn't contribute, and therefore I didn't see any point in my going. But they always came back. Robin Richards will tell you more. I don't think we know yet why they didn't find the pinpoint. They had radar, primitive, but they did have radar, and they thought they were at the right place, and they weren't. So he will tell you how this happened. Now, otherwise, I remember very little about the day-to-day transactions. I have a kind of list of the people who came over from time to time and had to be put up and who had information or who asked for arms, but I didn't get in touch with these people. I think I have one or two notes from them. And I think the next stage really is as it drew to the armistice. One thing I will record, although it's perhaps not very creditable, I was in touch, very close touch, with a Frenchman, a French officer, whose name I've now forgotten, and he came to me just before the end of the war, I suppose perhaps before the armistice or perhaps after, and asked whether we could, I think we'd done it before, arrange for the French to tank up with petrol from our supplies. And I was told by higher authority, Betts, who'd had it, I think, on higher authority, that we mustn't do this. And the reason, of course, was that the French were really behaving rather badly on the frontier. They wanted to, you know, get their own back on the Italians for having wanted to take over Nice. You remember that that was all part of Mussolini's program. And we were therefore told by London, I think, not to help the French in this endeavor. I'm wondering whether, oh yes, there's another, perhaps irrelevant. I remember that our relations, of course, with the Soviet Union were very close still. They were our allies. And at a certain point when I was in Nice, I can't remember why, they decided to have a Soviet national anthem instead of the international. And this, I remember the words of it and I remember the tune, but I won't, well, I will inflict the first bit on you. It said, Союз, Союз, нерушимых республик советских сплотила навеки великая Русь. And it went on that way. It was a Russian tune. It may have been written by a well-known composer, because I know the Russians had a competition. Anyway, I went to some kind of theatre performance. I can't remember what it was, but a lot of these old Russians were there. And when this was played, a lot of them had tears in their eyes, you know. A real Russian, a new Russian anthem. It wasn't, of course, the old one, the one you can hear in 1812. You know. Sorry, if that's irrelevant, I hope it can be deleted. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what the end of the... Oh, yes, I also remember, since he's died now, I can tell this story. When peace came, we took rations, English rations, and we went into one of the better-known towns. It might have been Digne, or it might have been... Anyway, I know that one of the people we got to know was the granddaughter of the painter Renoir, whose hometown was, I can't remember which it was now. Anyway, we went to one of these places and we had a good dinner in a restaurant. And after the dinner, when the band, little orchestra started to play, Squadron Leader Betts, Buki, beckoned to them and asked to borrow a violin. And he thereupon, to our great surprise, because he never let on that he could play the violin, he played this, I think it's a Chardash by Monti. He goes, da 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 da. And then later on he goes, dum bum 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 bum, da lum da lum da lum da lum. And he played this like Billy-O, and we were quite amazed. And he'd kept this under his hat all those years. I don't think you'll find it in the annals of number one special force, at least not until now. So we then dispersed. I can't remember quite how, and I was posted to military government in the Venezia, the telecommunications department, which was helping to put together the telecommunications of the region. And the office was in Venice, in the headquarters of the Telve, which was the Compagnia Telefonica delle Venezie, which no longer exists, of course. And every morning I would get up and have breakfast and go out of the Hotel Luna, which no longer exists, which was on the Piazza San Marco, walk across the Piazza San Marco, go under the orologio, where the Moors are, who beat the bell, and walk along Merceria and go to the offices of the Telve and do my work. That I remember very well. And also I went around the various places, other places, to see that they were all right, because we were in fact helping them to put the telecommunications in order, although they hadn't been damaged as much as they might have done. The man I principally worked with was a man called Ingegnere Dani of the Telve. He'd served in the States. He'd worked in the States and had good English. And we also worked with a man, I don't know whether this is relevant, there was, you know, if you were high up, you'd become a commendatore, cavaliere, and there was a commendatore Minotti, who was a superior officer of the telecommunications, who was also, you know, we got to know him and worked with him. And we had the loan, it was Dani's use of an old Fiat. And we used to go around the provincial areas with this Fiat. And part of the time, we went on the first ever Autostrada motor road, built by Mussolini between Turin and Milan. You couldn't get off it once you were on it, as I remember, but you could go like Billy-O when you were on it. And we had the pleasure of going along this motor road. Now, in Duke, and I really felt I got on very well with the Italians, and perhaps I'd add something else. No, I won't add it on the record. I'll tell you it off the record. Anyway, in due course.
Just about your time in Venice.
Yes.
Two questions, really. Can you recall much about life, generally, social life in Venice, and perhaps where you billeted? And secondly,
in the Luna.
Oh, of course.
In the Hotel Luna. Social life, very little, very little. Well, I do remember also going to Verona. I had a cousin of mine went recently on a... Sorry, this is almost irrelevant, except that it reminded me of it. And to Verona for some kind of music festival. And when she told me about it, and I said, oh yes, did you go to Piazza delle Erbe, the grass square where they sold herbs and things? Yes, she said, how did you know about it? Well, I said, I went there. And as I've also shown, this is all part of your question and the answer to your question about the social life, the staircase where Romeo, the real Romeo, is supposed to have gone up, or been killed, I think, even, by the Manteca. Oh, I was also shown, that's right, I was shown in the countryside round Verona. This was the original country where the... Anyway, I was shown what purported to be the villas of the Capuletti and the Mantecchi, you see. But what I can't remember, my memory fails me, this was called the architecture, which everybody, I know the name, it's the architect who resuscitated this kind of classical form. You probably come to your subconscious before it comes to mine. Sorry. It doesn't. It's irrelevant. But it's relevant because it was his territory, and a lot of these buildings were built in his style, which went all over Europe. And it's absurd that I can't remember it. Anyway, that's your answer to your question about the social life.
Also, was Venice, was it still in one piece?
Venice hadn't been touched at all. And of course, only one thing, of course, there weren't so many, there were a lot of gondolas. I got ill at one point, and a gondola had to take me to hospital, where I was diagnosed as having pyrexia of unknown origin, and discharged. There's a picture of me, actually, lying back in a gondola. I can't think why. Otherwise, the only difference in Venice was, of course, that there were very few craft except for gondolas. The telephone company had an electric barge, which met me when I arrived, took my kit and took me to the hotel, and you know, I used it after that. But otherwise, I can't remember. There must have been Vaporini, the little buses. But I can't remember whether they were. I never used them, because I walked about Venice, looking at the stones of Venice, and being very impressed, as I still am, by San Marco and by the square. I think the square is the most marvellous piece of... I mean, San Marco is a piece of kitsch in many ways, but I was most impressed with it. The second time we went there, I went there with my wife. We took pictures. Transparencies in the sun, and I still love them. I'd better stop there. And because the next step would be that a letter came one day saying, you are likely to be given early release from the army so that you can go back to Cambridge. And I thought, wacko. And I waited and corresponded a bit with the Cambridge authorities and was advised by the very nice tutor to have Santa Pazienza, which I tried to get, and eventually I left there. But I will just one last thing. I eventually took the civil service exam, and I think that one of the things that helped me was that my boss in Venice, Major Air of the United States Army, but also of the American AT&T communication form, had given me a good chit. And I think that was part of the evidence on which I was, I suppose, assessed when I went to my civil service examination. Well, perhaps I could stop there, slightly personal note. Anything else?
There was only one final thing.
Yes, please.
And that was the codes and the poem.
Oh, yes, that's right.
This would have been before you dropped in to...
We had a part of the preparation. We had to be given a poem with which we could transpose texts in case we hadn't got our one-time pads. These, of course, being the most the absolutely unbreakable form of cipher. And I suppose, I did have a lot of pads with me together with the crystals when I was going to jump in. Anyway, I chose the poem. You had to have 26 letters. And as I recall it, I chose... the sonnet of Dante, I suppose it was to Beatrice, but I can't... Anyway, it says, tanto gentile e tanto onesta pare, la donna mia quand'ell'altrui saluta, ed ogni lingua divien tremando muta, e gli occhi non adiscon di guardare. Well, I won't bother to translate it for you, but the first two lines, as I recall, have got 26 words in them, and I use the first letter of each word. Fine.